Mr. Collins?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. And before you both start, I just want to remind the lawyers that you do have 2 minutes to present your case without interruption from us. And after those 2 minutes are up, you should be prepared for questions from the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, Patrick Collins on behalf of the appellants, the City of Roseville, and Officers Jorgensen and Eckert in this matter. Your Honors, this is a case involving qualified immunity and the use of deadly force. And therefore, the legal issues before the court are whether a reasonable officer in Officer Jorgensen and Eckert's position could have believed that Mr. Berkeland posed an imminent threat of serious physical harm to the officers. And number two, whether the use of deadly force under these circumstances was forbidden by clearly established law. In our case, the officers are entitled to qualified immunity because a reasonable officer in their position clearly would have believed that Mr. Berkeland was an imminent threat of serious physical harm. And number two, more importantly, no court has ever forbidden the use of deadly force under these circumstances. And these circumstances, Your Honors, are the undisputed facts found by the district court, which are the following. Mr. Berkeland was hiding from the police in a 2.5 foot wide by 7 foot 5 inch long bedroom closet. Officer Jorgensen ordered Berkeland to come out of the closet. Mr. Berkeland refused. Officer Jorgensen slid open the closet door and at gunpoint ordered Berkeland to come out of the closet. Again, Mr. Berkeland refused. Instead, Mr. Berkeland produced a long knife and stabbed a canine officer in the head directly in front of Officers Jorgensen and Eckert. This was less than 7 feet 5 inches away from the officers at the time. Afterwards, at gunpoint, Officer Jorgensen at gunpoint ordered Mr. Berkeland to drop the knife repeatedly. Mr. Berkeland refused. Instead, while being less than 7 feet 5 inches away, and after stabbing a dog in the head, and after refusing numerous orders to drop the knife, Mr. Berkeland turned towards the officers, faced them, and came out of the closet with the knife in his hand. Despite these undisputed facts, the district court found that there was denied qualified immunity, claiming there are fact issues with regard to whether or not the officers had a probable cause to believe that a felony had been committed. The district court also found that a reasonable juror could believe that Mr. Berkeland was not an imminent threat to the officers, and if so, the use of deadly force would have been forbidden under Tennessee v. Gardner. Your Honors, the district court's decision must be reversed because the district court applied the wrong legal principles, and again, as more importantly, no court has ever forbid the use of deadly force under these circumstances. I'd like to first address the second prong of the qualified immunity analysis, and then I'll go to the first prong because I think the second prong is decisive of the issue in this case, which is that there's no the plaintiff in this case has the burden to show that there is a prior decision that forbid the use of deadly force under these circumstances, and it has failed to do so at the district court level, and it has failed to do so at this level. In particular, Your Honor, there is no case law that forbid the use of deadly force under these circumstances. In fact, all the case law from this circuit and also from the Supreme Court justified the use of deadly force under these circumstances. For example, in the decision of the state of Morgan versus Cook, in that situation, Mr. Morgan was 12 feet away from the officer, Officer Cook at the time. He was attempting to conceal a knife. He refused to drop the knife at gunpoint, and he lifted a foot as if to take a step. He didn't take a step, but he lifted a foot as if to take the step, and he was shot and killed by Officer Cook. This court found that that was a reasonable use of deadly force under the circumstances. In our situation, the situation was much more harrowing, much more violent, and much more frightening, because unlike Mr. Morgan, Mr. Berkeland used the knife.
And I do have a question about the use of the knife. It's not quite clear to me in the record. As you presented it just this afternoon, you said that Mr. Berkeland stabbed the dog in front of the officers, but that's different than saying the officers saw it. Is there evidence in the record that one or more of the officers witnessed that stabbing? Because I thought there was some question as to whether or not that happened, and there was concern that it might have happened, but I didn't know if anybody testified they saw it.
Yes, Your Honor. Officer Jorgensen testified that he witnessed it, he saw it, and in fact, the plaintiff has admitted in their complaint that it actually happened. So it's an undisputed fact that the district court found that Mr. Berkland did stab the dog directly in front of Officer Jorgensen, who was witnessing the whole thing. And he was less than 7 feet from the officers when it happened. And I want to be clear that 7 feet, 5 inches is actually the far end of the closet. It's the drywall. So actually, Mr. Berkland was much closer than 7 feet, 5 inches, but giving, with all facts construed in favor of the plaintiff, we're saying he was closer than 7 feet, 5 inches at the time of the incident.
Counsel, what about the fact that there seems to be a factual dispute about whether the dog was pulling Mr. Berkland towards the officers, or whether he lunged or moved towards the officers? If we assume that the dog was pulling him towards the officers, you know, does that change your view of the deadly force used in this case?
No. To answer your question, Your Honor, no, it does not. The district court did not find, it was pure speculation that the dog was biting Mr. Berkland at the time of the incident. In fact, the district court found that at the time of the shooting, the dog was attempting to re-engage its bite, which means it wasn't engaged at all. And I would argue that just like the officers in the estate of Morgan versus Cook, and in the recent case of Swergen v. Judd, both officers argued that the victim in those cases lunged towards them or moved towards them. And this court held that for summary judgment purposes, let's assume that he wasn't moving towards them at all. The shooting was still reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, and no court forbid the use of deadly force under those circumstances. And that's precisely what we could do in this case, Your Honor, Your Honor, is that I don't believe it changes the analysis at all. And in fact, if we assume for summary judgment purposes that Mr. Berkland was not moving towards the officers, it falls directly in line with the estate of Morgan versus Cook case. And in the recent case that this court sent down in Swearinger v. Judd, where officers confronted a man in a closet similar to ours in close quarters. And in that case, Mr. Swearinger held the knife down by his leg. He didn't make any movements towards the officer. The officer repeatedly ordered him to drop the knife. He refused to, and he was subsequently shot and killed. In this court held, and I want to make sure I quote this correctly from the opinion, it held that when it granted qualified immunity, it held it was not firmly established in August of 2014 that an officer was forbidden to discharge his firearm when suddenly confronted in close quarters by a non-compliant suspect armed with a knife. That's precisely what happened in our case, Your Honor. Mr. Berkland was non-compliant, but unlike Mr. Swearingen, Mr. Berkland didn't conceal a knife or attempt to conceal a knife. He used the knife. He stabbed a police canine officer in the head less than 7 feet in front of officers. And then after he got done stabbing the police dog, he turns and faces the officers, and at gunpoint, repeatedly refuses to drop the knife.
I want to follow up on this. You mentioned that it was speculative that the dog was still biting Mr. Berkland. I want to know the difference here. Was there no evidence that the dog was biting Mr. Berkland at the time, or did the district court dismiss that evidence and say, look, I just think that evidence is speculative? I just want to understand the record here.
Yes, it's my understanding that the plaintiffs offered an expert opinion with regard to that opinion, but the district court did not consider that on the for summary judgment purposes. Consider that speculation. There was no other than an expert. Go ahead.
Excuse me. Didn't the district judge in the findings in his statement of facts say that the dog had engaged, the handling officer was attempting to pull the dog away, and that the dog attempted or re-engaged? I think that's, and I don't have the language right in front of me, but that's my recollection of the record.
Actually, Your Honor, what the district court said was at the time of the shooting, the Officer Jorgensen was pulling the dog out, and the dog was attempting to re-engage its bite. which means it wasn't engaged.
Okay. In Swearingen, the person who was shot was a suspect from as a fleeing felon. It was a property felony, but it was still he was still fleeing and had fled into his home and then into his closet. And the closet had doors on both sides of it. So there were some reasons to indicate that had he wished to just evade the or avoid the confrontation, he could have gone out the back door of the closet. But now in this case, there's no other way out. The dog is either engaged or not engaged, and he's just a emotionally disturbed person who you're there on a community caretaker function. Does that make any difference at all?
I would disregard with some of the characteristics of the evidence you said, Your Honor, but in our situation, we didn't know who was in the closet. We didn't know it was John Berklin in the closet until after the use of force was used. We entered the apartment on the understanding or on the suspicion that a robbery had taken place. We didn't know how many people were in the apartment. We didn't know how many people were in the closet or if there were any weapons in the closet. So to answer your question, whether or not the officers could have done something differently, I would argue does not change the use of force analysis. We don't judge officers' actions by 20/20 hindsight of what could happen. It's whether a reasonable officer in their position would consider Mr. Berklin an imminent threat of great bodily harm or death at the time, and whether or not the use of force is forbidden under those circumstances. There was no evidence that we knew of that it was Mr. Berklin in there, or in the closet, or it was someone else. And there was no evidence that he was actually having an emotional breakdown at all, Your Honor. That was not part of the district court's finding. But to answer your question, whether or not he was having an emotional breakdown or was having some kind of mental episode, it would not change the Fourth Amendment analysis. We still judge the reasonableness at the time of the use of force. And in this case, I would argue that the use of force was reasonable, just as Your Honor had found with the Swearingen decision. I know that decision was determined on the second prong of the qualified immunity analysis, but I understand you specifically concurred that even under the first prong, the use of deadly force under that situation would have been found reasonable.
In this case, you've mentioned the concern about there being someone else in the apartment. As I understood the record, the dog went through the kitchen and another room, the bathroom, and then he alerted or whatever term they used to find a human in the bedroom. Did the record show that there were other rooms in the apartment that were of concern for the officers?
To answer your question, Your Honor, at the time they cleared all the rooms except for the bedroom at that time when the dog alerted to the closet. The issue was Officer Jorgensen could not tell if there was anyone else in the closet other than the person that he was seeing when he opened up the closet door. And he also couldn't tell whether he couldn't see Mr. Berklin's hands. And he couldn't tell if there were any other weapons there in there at the time he ordered Mr. Berklin out of the closet. And then when Mr. Berklin refused to do so, that's when Officer Jorgensen slid open the closet door and at gunpoint ordered him to come out with his hands up. Again, he refused. And that's when the dog he witnessed Mr. Berklin reach down to the floor. And that's when he released the dog. And that's when Mr. Berklin came up with a knife and stabbed the dog in the head in front of Officer Jorgensen.
And does the record show that he saw both hands at that point? So we've got one hand with the knife that was used against the dog, and then the other hand is free? Is he a right-handed person? I don't know which way that went, but did he see hands?
I don't believe the record shows that he saw the other hand, Your Honor. I'll save the rest of my time for any rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Barenbrinker, we are prepared for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, I am James Barenbrinker. My co-counsel, Karen Chiano, and I, together, we represent D. Dean Berkland as trustee of the estate of his brother John Berkland, who was shot and killed on February 10th, 2016 by two Roseville City police officers, John Jorgensen and Kyle Eckert, who along with a 75-pound Belgian Malinois police dog, Sergeant Adams, their street supervisor, and at least four other Roseville City police officers who were inside John's one-bedroom apartment to check his welfare. At summary judgment, the district court concluded that genuine issues of material fact precluded summary judgment for defendants on the deadly force claim and denied qualified and official immunity on the deadly force claim. Jorgensen and Eckert's interlocutory appeal followed. The district court granted police officers qualified and official immunity based on the trustees' claims concerning forced entry of John's home and the deployment of a police dog under a bite and hold command, and Sergeant Adams based upon immunity of, based on qualified immunity on a failure to supervise claim. Trustees' cross appeal followed. Your Honors, the facts in this case are in tremendous dispute. The trustee proffered significant evidence which contradicts appellant's version of how the events unfolded and unfolded on the night of February 10th, 2016. The question of what is known to the officers is reviewable by the court to determine if facts would inform a reasonable police officer that his actions violate legal standards. So in this case, what did the police officers know and when did they know it? When police arrived at the scene, they knew that two of Berkland's neighbors had telephoned requesting a welfare check on the man who lived in apartment 11 because they could hear a man screaming and hollering inside his apartment. That was another, they described it as another verbal outburst inside his apartment. And they informed the police that he may have mental health issues. Based upon those requests for a welfare check, officers Christensen and Vang were dispatched by the Roseville Police Department to Berkland's apartment in order to check on him. On the way to the apartment, they learned that there was a bench warrant for a nonviolent misdemeanor, which Berkland may not be aware of. So when Christensen and Vang arrived at John's apartment, Officer Christensen turned on his body cam and recorded the events at Berkland's home. A copy of the body cam audio and video, it may be found at Appendix 128, and a copy of the transcript of the audio recording is at Appendix 408. The transcript was at summary judgment was originally attached to the affidavit and incorporated into the affidavit of Janelle Lundberg, who prepared the transcript, and that's located at appendix page 396. The actual transcript of the recording is at page 408 of the appendix. It's very important to review the recordings on the body cam because that the recordings, the audio or the audio and video recording produced by the police department in connection in discovery in this case is time marked, or it's time minute and second marked in right on the video. And what it shows is that at the 1 minute and 15 second mark of the body cam recording, Officer Christensen shouted, "John, it's the police, open the door." Within 4 seconds, John was at the door and responded, "Oh, I'm okay."
Could we go forward, maybe fast forward through that timeline so we can maybe focus more on what happened and what's really truly in dispute in the bedroom? And because I'm curious of what, if everyone agrees sort of on a timeline during when it's blacked out, and I'm not sure why that is, but there's a time when you can no longer see from the camera. And is there a dispute as to how much time passed between the dog going in, the what everyone I think is assuming is the bite, the withdrawal, then potential re-engagement, and then the shots. Is that in dispute?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. The Sergeant Adams, once Jorgensen gave the command at the threshold of the door to the dog to find him, that was at the 24:33 mark of the video. It only took the officers approximately 1 minute to locate John inside the closet of his bedroom. At the 24:27 mark, Jorgensen can be heard yelling, "Come out of the closet, you're going to get bit." 2 seconds later, Jorgensen states, "I got contact." Officer Eckert and Jorgensen both testified that when he said, "I got contact," that meant that he could see Jorgensen, or Berkland rather, inside the bedroom closet. 1 second later, at the 24:30 mark, officer says, "John, come out of the closet with your hands up. You're under arrest." 24:33, Jorgensen announced, "The dog's on. Come on, John." The dog's on command testimony from the officers means that the police dog was already in the closet and already biting Jorgensen. After the dog was in the closet and biting Jorgensen at the 24:35 mark, Jorgensen said, "I can't see his hands. Come on out." 1 second later, Jorgensen says, "Show your hands." One more sec. "You're under arrest." 24:39, "Let go of the knife." So Jorgensen did not see a knife. He testified, the camera, the recording from the body cam proves or shows conclusively that when Jorgensen did not see a knife, no knife appeared until after the dog had been in the closet biting and attacking Mr. Berkland for at least a minimum of 6 seconds.
Well, counsel, I think you're still focusing on stuff that is part of the cross appeal, and I'm not sure that the cross appeal is actually before us. I think, and I don't want to speak for Judge Kelly, but I can tell you what I'm interested in. I'm interested in what happened after that for the use of deadly force, because the district court broke it down into discrete uses of force and discrete actions by the officers. And so I'm trying to focus in on what I think might actually be before us.
Well,
unless you can make the connection.
Well, in terms of the use of force, Your Honor, the time is critical, because when counsel was giving his recitation of the facts, it's not in it. We dispute his recitation. We've proffered much evidence, and the most important critical evidence, we believe, in terms of how the events actually unfolded when the two officers shot and killed John Berkland, can be gleaned directly from the body cam audio and video, but the audio recording, because at 24:41 on the recording, the dog yelps. Jorgensen then says, simultaneously, "Let go, let go, let go." 24:43, less than 3 seconds after John defends himself against the attacking dog, 4 shots are fired. 24:44, officer says, "Stop, stop." When the officers shot Jorgensen, officer Jorgensen and Eckert shot John, the dog had been in the closet for 6 seconds, attacking him, biting him. Jorgensen did not say that he couldn't see his hands or mention "show your hands" until after the dog was already attacking him. The knife didn't appear until after the dog had been biting him and attacking him from 6 to 8 seconds. And then when Jorgensen says, when the dog yelps, within 2 or 3 seconds, the officers kill him, shoot him 3 times, four shots, hit him 3 times.
Is there enough time then? I mean, the theory that I understand you to have made before the district court was that the dog had re-engaged and it bit Berkland again, and it pulled him out of the closet towards the officers. I'm not sure that there's time for that. Maybe I'm wrong.
We didn't argue, Your Honor, that he re-engaged. We argued that he was biting, he attacked Jorgensen, and we pointed to the autopsy records, the autopsy report that's part of the record, which showed that John suffered at least 10 deep puncture wounds, which exposed, which was down to and exposed the bone, exposed, revealed ligaments, tendons, and fascia. All of that occurred during this, we contend, and we believe the record shows, all occurred during the 6 to 9 seconds that the dog was attacking and biting John in the closet, had been sent in there immediately after Jorgensen made contact. Within 1 second or 2 seconds of Jorgensen saying, "I got contact," he sent the dog in. The dog's in there for 6 or more seconds biting Jorgensen. As soon as he's stabbed, within two to three seconds at the most, Jorgensen and Eckert fired 3 times or 4 times and hit him 3 times, killing him instantly.
In your view, where was the dog at that time? Was the dog still biting Mr. Berkland, or was the dog doing something else?
We believe that the dog was attached to Berkland. We believe the record shows that the dog was attached to Berkland throughout. Jorgensen testified that he pulled the dog out of the closet, and Berkland then got himself into a football stance and lunged or launched himself out of the closet, and Jorgensen shot John. And then once Jorgensen shot John, John either fell back into the closet or went back into the closet out of fear, is what Jorgensen said. We offered there's significant evidence in the record showing that contradicts Jorgensen's statement that John ever left the sitting or squatting position at the back of the closet. In fact, Eckert, who fired one time, testified that John, when he fired, John was sitting or squatting and at the back of the closet, and that the dog was on John, was between the officers, and that there's a lot of clothes and so on hanging in the closet. And Eckert testified he had about an 8-inch window to shoot through in order to hit Berkland.
So the underlying theory is he wasn't a threat. At that point, the dog, in your view, the dog was attached to him. He was in a sitting or squatting position, and therefore he would not have constituted a threat to the officers.
That's correct. The other evidence that's in the record to dispute Jorgensen's rendition or version of the facts is that, well, besides the autopsy report and the nature of the injuries, it would have been almost impossible for Jorgensen to physically do in 2 seconds what Jorgensen claims that he did.
Well, how is that impossible physically? I mean, you've said that a number of times, and I'm just having a hard time with that, because a man can run 18 yards in 2 seconds. It happens on every single day on some football field someplace. A person can explode out of a football stance and move 4 yards in less than a second, right? And so it's not physically impossible. And there's nobody who's testified, as I understand it, about what exactly happened there, except the officers. And their version is that he lunged forward. And now, whether he lunged or fell or whatever, I'm not sure that really matters if you look at our line of cases that talk about mistaken but reasonable use of deadly force. But I mean, why is it impossible? I don't get that.
Under the totality of the circumstances and the particular facts in this case, Your Honor, Officer Eckert testified that Jorgensen was seated or squatting at the back of the closet, that the dog was on him, that the dog was in between Berkland and Jorgensen and him when he fired. He testified he did not see Jorgensen get up or come at the officers. He testified that he had to fire through what he described as an 8-inch window between the low end of the window being the dog and the upper being the overhanging clothes. And then you couple that with the fact that with the defendant's own expert testified, he described the closet as providing significant geometrical obstacles or something like that, because there were laundry baskets or plastic containers, boxes, and so on the floor in the closet, making it very difficult for anybody to walk through the closet to begin with. But you combine all of that with a dog who's attached to Berkland, and the testimony of Eckhart that he was attached, plus the second cover officer told the BCA rather, he tried to contradict himself at his deposition, but he did testify under oath that his what he said to the BCA during that interview was truthful. He told the BCA that he could see before the shooting, Berkland's left leg was flat on the floor, and that it wasn't, you know, as if he thought he might have even been laying on the floor before the shooting. And we know that all of this could only have been a second or two before the shooting, because from the time Berkland stabbed the dog in self-defense, only 2 to 3 seconds elapsed before he was dead.
Counsel, I want to follow up on that, because I think that Judge Erickson's raised an interesting point, which is, you know, if you assume or that a human being can do something in a couple of seconds, and you have Berkland having just stabbed the dog in the head, isn't a reasonable officer thinking, I might be next, right? He's only a couple of feet away. He's already shown aggression towards the dog. And even if he hasn't lunged yet towards the officers, assuming that we can, you know, construe the record in that way, a reasonable officer might say, geez, I got to protect myself. This guy's dangerous.
Well, the question is whether or not the officers would have had probable cause to believe that Berkland presented an imminent, immediate threat of serious bodily harm or death. Under the totality of the circumstances, given the time that elapsed, the officers did not give Berkland an opportunity to respond to their commands. But most importantly, there was a dog attached to John. He was biting him. He had bitten him. He had 10 deep puncture wounds in his right knee and upper leg area. If you look at the photographs that part of the record show, when they pulled him out, his right knee pants leg was completely torn and ripped from where the dog was pulling on him and nagging at him and trying to get and getting at him in order to bite him. All of this had to have happened within the biting, and so on took place over 6 seconds before he even stabbed the dog.
Is there relevance to the fact, though, that I know your argument is he didn't have time to respond to the officer's commands, but is there relevance to the fact that they had spent a great deal of time earlier? I understand in a different context, asking Mr. Berkland to comply, open the door, you know, other things, and he had refused, from what I can tell, to comply at most steps in the process. Is that relevant to what the officers were facing?
No, I don't believe so. I think it's relevant. They claim that they entered the forced entry into John's home pursuant to the caretaker exception to a warrant requirement. When they did that, they knew they didn't have a warrant, and they're claiming that that they could go in there based on a reasonable belief, a rational, reasonable belief that there was an emergency or there was a situation that required their attention. But yet they waited outside the apartment for 20 minutes before going into the apartment. Once they went into the apartment, within a minute they had cleared the apartment. They had located him in the closet. At that point, if the purpose was in fact a welfare check and the purpose for breaking in was pursuant to the caretaker exception to a warrant requirement, was to merely locate John, mission accomplished. They should have removed the dog at that point in time. They didn't do that. Instead, they immediately, upon contact, within 1 second, sent the dog into the closet for one purpose, to bite him and to hold him. That was the command, that's how he was trained, and that's what the dog did. He did exactly what he was trained. And then 6 to 9 seconds later, John defended himself against this excessive force, which is legal under Minnesota law. He has a right to defend himself against this dog because it was unreasonable, as the district court concluded. I see my time is up.
Judge Kelly, can I ask one more question that I forgot to ask, which is the official immunity. I just want to understand your position on this. If the officers have official immunity, then does the city have vicarious official immunity? In other words, do they depend on each other?
I would say that if the officers are liable or are culpable under are not granted official immunity, I believe that the city would be culpable as to Sergeant Adams. Excuse me.
Does that go the other way too?
Most likely.
If the officers are not liable or get official immunity, then the city would as well.
I believe that's true. I didn't brief that.
Sure.
I don't off the
Fair
top.
Enough.
Sorry.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barenbrinker. Mr. Collins, I think you have some rebuttal time.
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. There's a few things I'd like to address. Mr. Barenbrinker mentioned a lot of arguments and accusations that I specifically addressed in my reply memorandum. A lot of the same arguments that he made at the district court fell on deaf ears because they weren't supported by the evidence. Everything we cited in our brief was cited by the district court. The district court did not find that the dog was attached at the time of the deadly force was used because there wasn't evidence to support that. The officers testified that once the dog was bit, the dog disengaged the bite. Once the dog was stabbed, the dog disengaged the bite. And the district court found that to be credible and true, and also found that at the time of the deadly force, that Officer Jorgensen was pulling the dog out when it was not engaged with Mr. Berkland, and it was attempting to re-engage its bite. That's what the evidence shows, and that's what the district court found. There is absolutely no testimony or evidence that Officer Eckert said that he saw the dog biting Mr. Berkland. That is pure fantasy. You will not see that within his deposition transcript whatsoever. What Officer Eckert said was when he peered inside the closet after Mr. Berkland had stabbed the dog, he saw Mr. Berkland facing the officers, still holding the knife and leaning towards the officers after stabbing the dog at a very close distance. In fact, he testified it was 4 feet at that point. Now, one thing that you did not hear Mr. Barenbrinker say once is he still has failed to cite one case in which the use of deadly force was forbidden under these circumstances, because he can't. There isn't a case that forbid the use of deadly force under these circumstances. All the case law, as Judge Erickson pointed out, whether or not he was coming towards the officers or not, the estate of Morgan, the Swearinger v. Judd, and even Casella v. Hughes case supports the position that the use of deadly force was reasonable under the circumstances, and more importantly, it was not clearly forbidden by clearly established law. And therefore, Your Honors, we ask that you grant Judge Strauss's question regarding official and vicarious official immunity. You're absolutely right. If the officers are entitled to vicarious official immunity, official immunity, then the city would be entitled to vicarious official immunity. So with that, we'd ask that you reverse the district court's determination judgment and grant the officers qualified immunity in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion in due course.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.